You're listening to episode 40 of the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie. My special guest today is law enforcement officer Brandon Griffith of the Griffith Blue Heart Organization.
Welcome to the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey folks, welcome to the Get Balanced podcast with me, your host, Dr. Donnie. And my special guest today is law enforcement officer, or is it former law enforcement officer, Brandon, or currently?
I'm still actively certified, but right now I've been taking a break to run the nonprofit, and I do have a couple applications with some departments.
There you go. And it is Brandon Griffith of the Griffith Blue Heart not-for-profit organization. And wow, does Brandon have a story to tell you, because it's not very often to where, well, it hasn't happened yet to where I said, hey, welcome this guest. And by the way, when he was 26 years old, he dropped dead. Brandon, why don't you take the story from there?
Yeah, you know, it's being a police officer. I really wish I could tell you I was doing something cool, like in a foot pursuit or on duty, but like 4 out of 5 cardiac arrests, I was at home with my wife. It's weird. I've been shot at. I've been in knife fights. I've been in water rescues, and I died at home reading a book.
Wow.
I was reading my book with my wife. I put the book down. I said, hey, I'm going to take the dog out. And it hit me like a freight train. Have you ever had someone jump out and scare you? And, you know, your heart skips a beat.
Yeah.
Well, imagine that feeling nonstop. And when you go through these critical stress incidents, you experience all kind of weird things like time distortion, tunnel vision, auditory exclusion. I'd been used to that in the line of duty, but not in my home. So in that moment, everything slowed down. Even though I collapsed within about a second and a half, to me, everything was in slow motion.
Wow.
Well, my wife turns around, sees my face as the darkest purple she'd ever seen. She immediately calls 911 as I collapse into our bookshelf. She's about 5'3". I'm 6'4". So when she tried to brace me, I toppled right over her and put my head through the wall. And I remember distinctly trying to force myself to do combat breathing. And when you're in ventricular fibrillation, it's physically impossible for the alveoli in your lungs to expand with oxygen. So I'm convulsing at this point in lockjaw, kind of wisping, going, trying to force myself to breathe. And that feeling of helplessness, I can't describe. And it's weird because most cardiac survivors don't remember their incidents, that when they do live, they wake up in the hospital days later. I remember every excruciating detail of my cardiac arrest. And as I landed on my hands and my knees, I'm looking out into my hallway, and I'm getting tunnel vision, but it's not like normal tunnel vision where you're looking through a coffee straw. It's more like this dark, dark purple, and everything's fluttering out on me. Now I know that that was the blood leaving my brain and ocular cavities. But in that moment, I remember just seeing my life stop. I collapsed. I dropped dead at that exact moment. My incredible wife, we were EMTs together before this. She had just been accepted to medical school. She rolls me over on my back and she starts doing CPR on me. It took about 4.5 minutes for the first police officer to arrive. He came over. He was not equipped with an AED, but he took over compressions for her and did just an absolutely phenomenal job. He worked on me until fire and EMS got on scene at the 9.5 minute mark. And according to their log, they worked on me for another like 8 minutes and 40 something seconds. So all in all, I was dead for 16, almost 17 minutes before I was finally resuscitated. And coming back, it was like a light switch. I distinctly remember the pain. My head hadn't been properly oxygenated for 16 something minutes. So with every single heartbeat, it just felt like someone was taking a sledgehammer in my head. I remember feeling that. My extremities, you know, when you have that pins and needles feeling when you fall asleep on them?
Yeah.
Imagine that on steroids. All my arms and legs just felt like daggers all over the place. I'd been shocked multiple times. I had an IO drill in my leg. I remember just pain. And according to my wife and the crew, I woke up, I started pushing guys off me. I don't remember any part of that. I do remember the sway of the gurney, and I can remember hearing their footsteps on the rocks in my front yard as they loaded me into the ambulance. And according to the guys, I was cracking jokes in the back of the ambulance, calling them hose draggers. And I still talk to the guys to this day. But I spent the next 5 days in the hospital. They were never able to figure out why I had this electrical malfunction. My heart's healthier than a horse. In fact, I just passed my department SWAT test 2 weeks before I made it on their list. So, I mean, I was in great shape, 26 years old, no stress, no diagnosis. I just had an electrical malfunction that caused me to drop dead like so many people do every day.
Wow. What a story. My gosh.
It's something that has had a true profound impact on my life. And I never thought that I would be doing the things that I am today. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. Now, how long were you married at the time?
So I actually married my high school sweetheart, and we've been together now 17 years, but we had just been married for 4 years at that point.
Oh yeah. Wow. That is some story. Well, tell us a little bit about the family. So your wife and then I think I read that you have a child or?
I have two. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. My wife, as I said, during the cardiac arrest, she had just got accepted into medical school. So she went to Midwestern Medical University where she got her degree in cardiovascular perfusion, and she actually works in perfusion. So we didn't have kids at that point because she had to do her rotation. She had to go out of state. She went to, you know, New Mexico and Utah and California, and she got her board certification, and then she was able to land a job back here in her home in Arizona. And that's when we decided we wanted to start having our family, but it's something that we always wanted. In 2018, we welcomed our son, Michael, who is now 3 years old. And then actually this last year, 7 months ago, we welcomed our daughter. So I've got two little ones right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome. 7-month-old girl.
They are the absolute light of my life. They have challenged me in more ways than I thought possible. And fatherhood is the best and most challenging thing I've ever been through. I'll tell you that.
What do you enjoy most about it?
Watching them figure things out in life. You know, my son is very active. He's like his dad. He likes to jump around. He likes to go outdoors, and watching that curiosity and that spark and figure things out, and his stubbornness, because he will challenge everything. He wants to do it his way, and watching him learn as he goes has been just a real rewarding thing. But I mean, obviously every time they jump in your arms and give you that hug, give you that snuggle, it makes every other trouble in your world melt away.
It certainly does. I'm a big believer in that. Now take me back to Brandon, if you will. So 26, you had the heart attack.
Cardiac arrest.
Cardiac.
I gotta correct you there, because now most of the public doesn't know the difference, because a heart attack is a plumbing issue and a cardiac arrest is an electrical issue. So when you see the stuff on TV where the guys are clutching their chest and they have that arm pain and they're sweating profusely, that's a heart attack. A cardiac arrest is an electrical malfunction where your heart shorts and you drop dead instantly. And that's what all those stories you hear of young athletic males and women just dropping while playing basketball or at the park, that's all cardiac arrest.
I see. I appreciate the clarification on that, actually. Yeah. Now, you went back to work, though, right?
I did. It was a struggle. And I can tell you, mentally, I was not in a good place. I was 26 years old. I was facing forced medical retirement because my command staff didn't understand what cardiac arrest was, even though it's the number one cause of death in our country. Most people have no idea what it is. So I had to fight to keep my job. At that point, I had to prove that I was safer than any of their officers, because everyone's at risk of going into cardiac arrest like I did. But now I was on medication to prevent it, and I had a defibrillator implanted in my chest to save me instantly if I did suffer it. But any other officer on the department that would have collapsed into it needs CPR and AED immediately, and they still only have a 1-9% chance of actually surviving that incident. So I had worked extremely hard to get where I was at life. I just passed the test for my SWAT team. I was a defensive tactics instructor, a field training officer. I was in a great spot with my wife, who'd just been accepted to medical school. And now I was facing losing all of it. And my problem was that my identity was too entwined with what I did and not who I was. So at that point, I was devastated. You know, not only did I have survivor's guilt, I buried too many friends in the line of duty. I was at this point where going, you know, these better men than me gave their lives in service. Why was I given a second chance? Why am I having this when better men than me gave their lives? And it was something that really messed with my head for a while. I had to learn how to overcome that. And I had to learn how to be comfortable with maybe not going back to the streets, even though it's been my passion my whole life. So I it took about 6 months. I fought. I had to prove to like risk management and the department. I brought in researchers. I brought in doctors who I'm still close friends with to this day that helped me return back to the field. And as far as I know, I have yet to meet another police officer with an automated internal implantable cardioverter defibrillator in their chest. So I may be one of the only ones in the country that returned to full active duty with it. And there was a lot of challenges in that too. I had to, what happens if you get tased? What happens with your radio? Do the magnets in this mess with your device? And there's not a lot of information. There's not a lot of resources. And one of the most frightening things for a new cardiac survivor is walking out of the hospital, because you have nothing. Most of the time you have your family, but your family's not equipped with it either. They just went through this traumatic incident with you where they literally watched you die or maybe worked on you like my wife did. And it's something that sticks with you for life, but there's almost no information. It's like, hey, you survived. Good for you. Get out there. And they kick you out the hospital door. There was no, I didn't get anything handed to me on discharge. I didn't get any information. I had to actively pursue these things myself and try to find survivors groups or information. And I had to educate myself, and it was a real challenge.
Yeah. Hey, Brandon, take me back to you mentioned something about identity was what you did, is associated with what you did versus who you were. Talk to us a little bit more about that. What do you mean?
I like too many, especially young cops. I've been a field training officer for a long time, and the young rookies come on and they just eat, sleep, and breathe being police officers. After work, they're hanging out with nothing but cops. They're working out. They're for fun. They're going target shooting. They don't do anything else with their life. And I was still a young officer at this point and recently DT instructor and field training officer. So I was all about it. My wife was busy with her academics. So I was putting too much of myself into my job. I wasn't focusing on the family as much. I mean, I didn't have any kids at that point, but I wasn't focusing on my other hobbies outside of work. There wasn't really a balance there. So when I was facing medical retirement, I was devastated because I was like, this is who I am. This is what I am. I'm a police officer. And it was a hard pill to swallow to realize that's not who you are. It's what you do. And what you do doesn't define you. There's tons of incredible police officers out there and firefighters that have had their careers cut short due to injuries or other things. And it messes with you not being a part of that camaraderie, that brotherhood, that importance. And I mean, for others that are like me that are adrenaline junkies, when you kick in someone's door and you know they're waiting for you with a weapon in the house, there's nothing like that rush and that feeling. And being deprived of that and being told you have to sit on the sidelines, it's still hard. I mean, I never thought in a million years I would be running a nonprofit and prioritizing that and my family over working the streets. If you would have told me after my cardiac arrest that I'd be running a nonprofit years later, I would have laughed in your face. There was no way I was going to walk away from working on the teams and being in the field. But yeah, I still miss that right now. Run the nonprofit. I want to go back to the field. I want to do that, which is why I can't quit it. I still work in a reserve capacity, but if I can never suit up again in law enforcement, I have come to peace with that, knowing that what I can do outside makes a larger impact.
Yeah. Now, how did you get through from, you know, that identity? Because the identity, what you're talking about is, you know, through maybe the forced medical type retirement, you were facing it, but a lot of people also face it at retirement. You know, it's that that identity crisis at that point. Did anything in particular help you get over the fence a little bit on that?
Serving and giving back to others in a different way. You know, like Booker Washington said, if you want to lift yourself up, lift someone else up first. And it's something that I hadn't immediately been adapted to. When I was facing retirement, I started looking out for researchers, and I was actually contacted by an incredible physician named Dr. Bentley Balbro. And he's one of the creators of Handling CPR at U of A with Dr. Kern. And he wanted to hear my story. And I said, look, I'll sit down with you, but I want to figure out a way to get back to work. And I sat down with him, and he was giving me information and helping me get back to the streets. But he says, I want you to come speak at a conference with me. I want you to come share. You have an amazing story. Why don't you come and share it? I was like, I'm a dumb street cop. I'm not a public speaker. I don't want any part of this. Like, just let me go back to the field. And he goes, well, why don't you just come and meet a couple of survivors? And if you feel comfortable, you can say a few words. Okay. So I end up showing up, and there's some of these survivors are sharing their stories, and they asked me if I wanted to share. And I said, you know what? Well, I'm already here, might as well. So I got up in front of the group, and I spoke at this little conference and this ceremony. And afterwards, some survivors and their family members came up to me and started hugging me in tears and telling me that they were so grateful that what I shared, they experienced the same thing. And I wasn't in a good mental state at that point. I was still fighting to keep my job at that exact ceremony, but being able to touch another survivor and their family members and realize that I was making an impact, being able to help them felt good. And it had been a while since I'd felt good. So I started going with them some more. I started speaking. I started networking with other survivors. And next thing I know, I am back in the streets and I started realizing how unprepared law enforcement is for cardiac emergencies. Yet we're on scene first 90% of the time before the fire department. Yeah. We're on scene in the first 3 to 5 minutes when we can make the biggest impact on survival, but we're not getting equipped with AEDs. I'm like, we wouldn't send our guys to an active shooter without a gun and a ballistic shield. Why are we sending them to the number one cause of death out of this piece of equipment? So I started creating these programs and serving others and working with my fellow police departments to implement AED programs, resuscitation programs. And once they started getting saves and I started getting phone calls, knowing that the programs that I gave back to touch other people's lives and gave them a second chance. They got to have kids. They got to have grandkids. They got to go on and do other things that they wouldn't have if my programs hadn't been in place. And having that service and being able to give back to others as a public servant meant everything to me. And there's a lot of guys that retire that come to me and say, you know, I'm bored, I'm depressed, I'm having all kinds of other issues. I miss the streets. And I said, start getting out of that circle by volunteering some capacity, go Special Olympics, 100 Club, whatever it is you got to do, go out there and help others because it'll make a huge, profound impact on your life. But you gotta balance it out. And just like we talked about with those rookies, you got to make sure that you do things outside of work and you balance yourself and you have friends outside of that inner circle.
Oh, absolutely. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Griffith Blue Heart? You're not for profit because you are doing fantastic work out there.
Thank you. So Griffith Blue Heart, like I said, after I suffered my cardiac arrest and went back to the field, I started looking around going, you know, I've done CPR. I don't know how many times. The guys I've trained have done CPR. I don't know how many times. Why aren't police departments being outfitted with it? Here in Arizona, there's 141 law enforcement agencies and only about 10% are outfitted with AEDs. That's a problem. So I started getting to work, figuring out why. Is this a cost thing? Is this a mentality? And traditionally, cops have not been associated with medical response. You know, that's always been fire and EMS, but we have significantly evolved over the years with the prevalence of active shooters and the opiate crisis. We started getting saves more and more. And when CPR changed to hands only and started providing better brain outcomes and quadrupled survival, we said, hey, hold on. Now I don't have to worry about getting throw up in my mouth. I don't have to worry about getting HIV. So cops are much more inclined to provide first aid. And now they're getting more saves in fire and EMS. So we started coming up with these programs to help police departments implement them, help them get the funding, help them write policies, dispatch protocols, field deployment plans. And then we started looking at the quality of training law enforcement has. And, you know, most of the time for our CPR courses, every 2 years, someone comes in, you do a PowerPoint, you get on a clicker mannequin and they go, hey, sing Stay Alive, you're certified, get back out there. And I'm like, we're not getting high quality resuscitation training. So when I started working with Dr. Balbro at CPR University and seeing these incredible resuscitation programs they were offering to providers, I said, let's adapt this to law enforcement.
Yeah.
And we took that firearms instructor mentality and that SWAT mentality of force on force, and we created a reality-based training program for law enforcement where they actually test their skills on feedback mannequins with evaluators, with instructors, and they have to go through phase-based learning, you know, classroom skills building, then stress inoculation. And it's so far no one else in the country has been adaptive to this, but it's something that we hope to spread and have continue to increase the quality of resuscitation in the field.
No, that is outstanding. And do you work outside of Arizona as well, or do you stay in Arizona?
I do. I'm actually heavily involved with the Citizen CPR Foundation. I sit on their 40 under 40 committee and their survivor committee. And we've been trying to get these programs expanded, but I do also do consulting work for organizations outside of Arizona that contact me that wish to implement AED programs or wish to have further training or help with grants or policies or recognition. We don't officially go other states. We don't market towards them. Our primary focus is on Arizona, but we do work out of Arizona.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, let me shift a little bit on the home front, since this is the Get Balanced podcast. Got to keep it balanced. Mention your wife, mention your two children. So when you think of balance, what is balance? What's it mean to you? What's a balanced life mean to you right now?
Well, I can tell you that it's challenging, especially when you're launching programs like this. There's a dichotomy to everything you do, and trying to figure out how to balance everything can be extremely challenging. Mm-hmm. Last week when you invited me onto your show, I listened to some of your previous shows and I listened to you give yourself a self-assessment on your balance. And yeah. I started thinking to myself, I'm like, you know what, where am I at right now? And I started realizing that I've been a little bit too much on the computer, a little bit too much on the phone, not focusing on what my kids need to be. So I need to balance that out. You know, this weekend I'm taking them up north. We're going to go up to Prescott and play in the woods and keep the phones and internet off and just focus on being with them and exploring and getting outdoors. Cause that always centers me, taking my kids out. You know, I'm a big mountain biker. I play basketball and racquetball and go see the friends. And my wife and I love music and we love getting out. So it's something that, there's a dichotomy to everything. You got to keep it balanced. Sometimes the pendulum switches on either side, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, well, that's great to hear. Yeah. And let me take you to the part of self-care, because I always preach a lot about self-care too. And obviously going through the cardiac arrest, you know, health is extremely important to you. And it was before, I mean, you had no idea that you were susceptible to that. But when you think about from even before that event and then after that event, has physical care, taking care of yourself, you know, whether it's exercise, proper nutrition, getting adequate sleep, you know, those type of things, as well as your mental health, like you said, getting outside in nature and recentering yourself and things like that. Has that always been a part of your life? And is it part of your family's life, you and your wife?
It's something that's been ingrained in me since I was very young. I'm a lifelong martial artist. I grew up around military and law enforcement. You know the prevalence of suicide and substance abuse and all kinds of too many things that plague us in this industry. And I definitely did not want to be like that. So yeah. It has been a priority to me. I absolutely love mountain biking. I love getting out with my family. But there are times where it's almost impossible to get good sleep. It's almost impossible to eat right. You try to, but there's going to be times where it's out of whack. And you got to start realizing, am I actually frustrated? Am I actually stressed right now? Or have I been getting enough greens? Have I been getting enough sleep? What happens if I don't do this event and I stay at home, is that going to help? And usually within 72 hours to, you know, a week, you start realizing that, all right, you know what, I was a little bit off key here. I need to get some sleep. I need to get some self-care. I need to go get a workout.
Yeah.
And it's exceedingly difficult with a young child, especially I have a 7-month at home right now and a 3-year-old. Trying to get good sleep is not happening. So
oh, that's true.
In order to combat that, me and my wife have to take turns. You know, some mornings I'll get up with the baby and let her sleep in bed when she's not working, but we have her on call schedule too. So there's times where it's impossible to get that good sleep. So what else can we do? Maybe we can work out. Maybe we can talk to a friend, go get a cup of coffee, something.
Yes. Yeah. You know, just the other day, this was yesterday. I was feeling low energy, and I have one of these Aura rings. You can't see it on the podcast, but you know, so I get sleep data. I get heart rate variability, all the great stuff. And it said I should have had a good day, right? But I'm dragging around low energy. It's in the afternoon, gets to the afternoon. And then, two of my daughters, my two youngest, they're juniors and seniors, and they had a track meet. So I had about a 45-minute drive out to this track meet, still feeling low energy. And I'm thinking, what the heck's wrong with me? You know, it's like, I've been working out, I've been sleeping pretty good, haven't been, you know, a bit too bad on the nutrition and all this stuff. Draining. But then I got to thinking about it. All right, I've been working out. What do I have to drink today? Well, let's see, I had 2 cups of coffee in the morning. I had a cup of coffee about lunchtime. I may have had a half a glass of water or something like that. And I was like, you know what? I'm hitting the concession stand buying a couple bottles of water. I'm going to put them down and see how I react. It was instant, you know, just boom, felt so much better. Energy mentally, right? Clearer and everything like that. And it's that self-care, as we, you know, we can joke about it, but sometimes it's just simple things like that, like damn, you know, I need to make sure I stay hydrated, you know, because it affects us.
That reminds me of a couple of stories we had. Arizona heat gets really bad. So that the hydration in the summertime, we're wearing all black, we're wearing outer vests, we're doing, sometimes you don't have the luxury of being able to go to the air conditioning. If we're serving a search warrant or if we're on a perimeter, you're stuck out there until you're relieved. And me and my partner were serving a search warrant. DPS officer's house had been broken into, his gun was stolen. We've had a lead on a residence. We were serving a search warrant on it. My partner was just irritable the entire day. I'm like, what is wrong with you, man? And I never once saw him drinking or doing anything there. We're serving this warrant and we're inside the house and he's trying to get this door open. I look over and he's doing the sway. And I look over and he's bone dry and bright red. I'm like, oh boy. So I ended up scooping him. We got relieved. I took him to the fire station and we got an IV on him. And he was singing and dancing by the end of the night. Well, all he had to do was get properly hydrated, one IV, and he was good to go.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Sometimes we just don't do some of these things that are very basic, yet so important, right? So important. Hey, let me switch over to, want to try to get an understanding. I always like asking my guests a little bit about, like your guiding, you mentioned martial arts. So I have a little bit idea of your past, but how about like growing up and your guiding principles in life? You know, what were they and what are they now when you think about what guides you and your family?
Now, growing up in studying martial arts from the age of four, everything was about service. Everything was about duty, honor, and brotherhood. And it's something that I've taken very lightly. I'm sorry, taken very seriously my entire life. You have got to walk the walk. You've got to talk the talk, and you've got to have discipline in all aspects of your life. And it's something that's grown with me. I was a troubled kid. I was always in trouble. I was one of those ADHD kids. I was suspended. If you would have told any of my teachers growing up that I'd have been a police officer, they would have laughed in your face. But honestly, my wife is the one that centered me. Getting into high school and being around her, I stopped caring so much about the brotherhood aspect of it because I found true love. And working with her, I originally was going to go into the military, but I knew that I wanted to be with her. So instead of going in the military and going into law enforcement afterwards, I decided to pursue law enforcement right away. And she turned me around. She made me a 4.0 student. She made me focus on my academics and getting to college. And she's been my guiding light in everything. I mean, she literally brought me back from death. And she's been there for all of it. Every time we've buried a friend in the line of duty, all those stressful nights, they go through everything that we do. And having her, having each other to lean on and being there for each other has been my biggest guiding point, that love, that unity, because without her, I couldn't do any of this.
Yeah. Well, you got to make sure she hears that part.
I try to tell her as much as possible. I don't deserve her.
Hey, when you think of one other piece of self-care, how about spiritual self-care? Is it prayer for you? Is it out in nature, meditation, a little bit of all three? Or
my whole life, my parents, I grew up Christian. I grew up going to church, and it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't a big deal for me growing up. I wasn't into it very much. I didn't like going to church. I stopped going as soon as I started working. All through college, I didn't really step into a church. But once I became a police officer, I definitely had a more spiritual connection with a lot of the things I started seeing. And after my incident, I did have an experience on the other side that will forever change me. And
I want to hear about that.
Well, that's not something I normally talk about publicly. Okay. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about that off of camera. Mm-hmm. But let's just say when I was on the other side, I had an experience and I was told to earn it. I was told to earn my second chance. And I've done an incredible amount of research and studying on near-death experiences. And I've worked with some top near-death doctors around the country that I've been introduced to, or around the world that I've been introduced to. And it's a fascinating subject when you start looking at what actually happens with the brain, with your endocrine system when you die. And you know, some people talk about they saw the light or they floated above the room. Most of those people, they were resuscitated very quickly within the first 3 to 7 minutes. But what I've been told is that after that 7 minute mark, your body cannot physically break down dimethyltryamine. It can't break down adrenaline. So it's no longer hallucination. You can only, your body can't physically process that. So those people that say, oh, that was just chemicals in your brain, you didn't actually experience that. Well, those that have been dead longer than that 7 minutes, like I was, I know for a fact that I was not here. I was on another plane of existence. And it was extremely comforting to know that you are you outside of this world, and having that experience and connecting with that person or that being on the other side is something that stays with me, which is why our company motto has become earn each day. I strive to earn every single day I'm given, because you never know when it's up. If you're going to take a bullet, get hit by a bus, have a brain aneurysm or a cardiac arrest. I died reading a book. So yeah. Every single day at the end of the day, when I tuck my kids in, I'm sitting there going, did I earn today? Was I a good husband? Was I a good father? Did I make an impact on my work? What did I do today? And if I didn't earn it, I'm apologizing to the big guy for not living up to that day. So it's something that I take very serious. And you know, I'm sure my wife is annoyed at me saying, I'm trying to earn my second chance. I got to earn this. And because it becomes more of a default blanket for me. So yeah. Does that answer your question? Or did I get up too far?
It does. Thank you very much for sharing that. Yeah. Hey, what are your toughest challenges today? What do you got? You know, you got not-for-profit going, you have the family going, is it easy, or is it, you still have some challenges out there?
Being a public servant and working in the business and nonprofit world is exceedingly difficult. You know, I'm used to being, every single cop, firefighter, military member in this country has wrote a blank check up into and including their own life. I know where their priorities lie. I know that when I'm suited up next to somebody that I can trust them, I know they've walked the walk and they're talking the talk. But transforming over into the civilian side of things, working with people that are not as adept in leadership and program implementation, it's been challenging, you know, because so many people are in the what's in it for me, or what, you know, what I'm used to, people that are serving others and trying to get rid of some of these mental blocks and trying to get the community to stop doing a silo effect. Everyone in the community wants to be the only one doing what they're doing. Instead of focusing on the bigger mission, instead of focusing on the leadership, they want to be the only one waving their flag. And either we do it, or you can't be with those people because they're our competitors. And it's like, we're trying to tackle cardiac arrest. We're trying to tackle a public service. And it's something that I really struggle with, of working in this community, that without that camaraderie and that shared brotherhood, I feel like I'm on an island. I feel like when I'm on the firearms range, or if I'm doing SWAT training with the guys, I am so at home, as I know where these guys are at and what their priorities are. But when I'm working and I'm speaking at these conferences, or if I'm teaching or sitting in a board meeting, it drives me nuts. It's extremely challenging to not share that those priorities, those values with the people that are trying to make the same headway in the mission than I am. It's a real challenge, because I'm trying to find a balance in that. And you can't control what other people do. You can only lead by example and hope that you influence them.
No. I get that. You know, I think a lot of us that do the work that we do with first responders, sometimes we do feel like we're on an island. You know, there are times very much. I was just talking to, he's out in your area, Dr. Dara. We were talking on the phone earlier today, and we both agree that sometimes, it's like we're on an island, but it's so good to get back, to have some of this, you know, and talk, as well as in-person events and things like that, which I think we all feel better with those in-person events. I don't know about you, but I sure do. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all about that interpersonal communication.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So when you, when I think about one of my steps in my workshop that you have not been to though, but what I do is I have a session on about desired future. So when you think about your future of your family, future of the company, and all, you know, whatever you think of as a future, what do you desire 3, 5, 10 years down the road?
My biggest desire in life is to raise my children to become great, honorable members of society. And that's something that is extremely difficult. You know, there's so many other outside influences and things that are out there, and I want my kids to have a great life. I want them to be happy. I see the state of mental health in our youth nowadays. My number one goal in life is to raise them to become great, honorable people, and let them really thrive at life and to be the best husband and father I can be. If those things are in balance, I don't care if I'm a stay-at-home dad. I don't care if I'm on the streets. My mission is very important to me because I know how many lives it can save, and I know how many people that it can impact on survivorship in law enforcement and EMS. I would love to see Griffith Blue Heart take off and be even more successful and go nationwide. But right now, I'm the only one doing what I'm doing, and I need to start bringing others up and empowering and inspiring them to take the lead in these programs, because I'm doing this by myself right now. I've got a board of directors that helps out, but they're full-time police officers and teachers, and trying to get people that are more dedicated to the mission and the cause would be great, but it has to be, you have to balance that dichotomy.
Yeah. Now, if some of our listeners would like to get some more information, where can they, where would you recommend that they go with Griffith Blue Heart?
If you go to griffithblueheart.com, you can learn a lot more about our nonprofit, what our mission is, and what services we offer to law enforcement. If you want to learn more about some of the survivorship and some of the leadership programs we offer, Citizen CPR Foundation, if you go to their website, you can learn a lot about the 40 Under 40 program, which I sit on the committee for, the Survivor program. We actually have a big summit coming up in December. I'm hoping, I put in a couple abstracts, I'm hoping to be speaking and presenting there, not only for law enforcement, but to the entire cardiac community. And that'll be coming up December 10th, 7th through 10th in San Diego.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Now, is there anything in this podcast that I did not ask you that you were hoping I would, or an area you'd like to spend additional time on?
That's a good question. No, you know what? I think we hit all the points that I wanted to discuss, mostly about with identity and overcoming and giving back to others. But you have to prioritize yourself in order to be there for those around you. You have to prioritize your leadership and all your programs. I'm glad we got to discuss that in depth today.
Now, Brandon, I want you to imagine someone's listening right now and they actually are having that identity issue. Talk to them. How do they take steps? Where do they go to get help? What would you recommend?
If you're having that identity issue where you are too entwined with what you do, you need to take a step back. You need to de-escalate and look at your situation honestly and start looking at what else you've got going in your life. And if you have nothing else, you need to find something else. Pick up a hobby, go work out, pick up a sport, go talk to somebody. Stop spending time online. Stop spending time worrying about what other people think, because most people don't give it a second thought. Literally look at your life and see how you can enrich it and value yourself. Go for a hike, go give back, volunteer for some kind of cause, become an instructor for something, go become a Stop the Bleed or a CPR instructor, go volunteer for the Special Olympics or Vets in Need, whatever it is you can do, give back to others. Because when you start giving back, you start finding who you really are as a person. You can start really figuring out where you want to be and how you prioritize things, especially when you see things that others don't. For law enforcement, for first responders, we see the best and the worst of humanity all the time. So when we're able to go out and see that on a daily basis, it's very easily to be reminded of what good we have in our life. When you're not a part of that, or you've been taking a break, retired, walked away, it's very difficult to remember those lessons on a day-to-day basis. So having a cup of coffee or talking to somebody outside of that circle and figuring out where people are can really start to center you. Just focus on other aspects of your life. And if you don't have other aspects, build them.
Yeah, that is some great advice. Well, thank you very much, Brandon. And one of the things I offer my guest on my show is to close it out. If you would like to close it out with a blessing to law enforcement, firefighters, and all first responders out there, I'll give you that opportunity if you'd like it.
You know what? I think I'll leave it with you. I'm a big fan of Matthew 5:13. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they're called the sons of God. But I very much a believer of God, but I haven't been able to do much on the pastor side of things. So I will leave it to you to close out, sir.
All right. Well, and that's what I would like to do, is that wish and pray for everyone to stay healthy, happy, and safe. Ask God to bless over not just all first responders, but also their families. And may they sit in comfort and not worry, and that everyone makes it home safely. With that, Brandon Griffith, thank you very much for being my guest on the Get Balanced podcast.
Dr. Donnie.
Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.